Hello and welcome to episode 380 of the UK True Crime Podcast. Thank you so much for joining me today. In this episode, researched and written by my good friend author Chris Wood, today's story from Suffolk is a familiar theme. It's reality versus the facade that we present to the outside world, love, lust, and jealousy. Sounds like a decent Friday night, huh? Talking of evenings, please join me on Sunday at 7 p.m. for the latest Podcasters Roundtable, where me, Mike and Paul will be joined by the excellent Bob and Ali from Twisted Britain. It's going to be a lot of fun. Just head to Crowdcast and search for True Crime Podcasters Roundtable. So let's set some context ahead of today's story with our Guest of the Month and Year game. Number 2 in the UK music charts was Milli Vanilli with Girl I'm Gonna Miss You. In the US, Miss You Much from Janet Jackson topped the charts. And the best-selling album of this year in Australia was Volume 1 from the Travelling Wilburys. In the news this month, the leader of East Germany, Erich Honecker, resigned. An earthquake in San Francisco killed 67 people. In the days before F1 was a procession and the texts from a team manager were more interesting than the actions on the track, McLaren teammates Alain Prost and Ayrton Senna collided and skidded into an escape road during the Japanese Grand Prix. Prost retired from the race and claimed his third Formula One World Drivers' Championship. In the UK, Michael Knighton dropped his bid to buy Manchester United. Nigel Lawson resigned as Chancellor of the Exchequer, replaced by John Major. And in UK true crime news, the Guildford Four were released from prison after the High Court quashed their convictions for the 1975 terrorist atrocity. So did you guess the month and year? It was October 1989. You didn't get it, did you? Again. This podcast is brought to you by Shopify. Shopify is the commerce platform revolutionizing millions of businesses worldwide by simplifying selling online and in person so you can grow your business. It covers all the sales channels and gets you selling across social media marketplaces like TikTok, Facebook, and Instagram. It's full of the industry-leading tools ready to ignite your growth. Shopify gives you complete control over your business and your brand without learning any of those pesky new skills in designing or coding. And thanks to 24/7 help and an extensive business course library, Shopify is ready to support your success every step of the way. I had a side hustle a few years ago. It was so difficult to actually sell the products and get paid. Changing things took me ages, but a friend recommended Shopify and it completely transformed everything. It just made it so easy to do, leaving me to focus on actually building the business. It's time to get serious about selling and get Shopify today. Sign up for a £1 per month trial period at shopify.co.uk/truecrime. That's all lowercase. Go to shopify.co.uk/truecrime to take your business to the next level today. shopify.co.uk/truecrime. Leavenheath is a delightful village to the north of the Essex-Suffolk border. It's midway between Sudbury and Colchester and adjacent to the Dedham Vale, an area of outstanding natural beauty, known for the artist John Constable. I have rowed on the lovely river there at Flatford, and if you are depressed of all these people knocking the UK, I urge you to head here on a sunny afternoon and rediscover what is so special about our country. Susan and Christopher Wybrow, who was a wealthy barrister, were the fortunate occupants of a beautiful farmhouse in Leavenheath, Spring Farm, set within 12-acre gardens. Entering their 10th year of marriage together, to many people, the couple had it all. The idyllic property, in the picture postcard village, and a comfortable lifestyle with no money worries. And yet, as we know, in all our lives, things are often not quite as they seem, especially with that Facebook effect, where so many of us sell our best possible lives to friends and family. Susan was known locally as a caring wife who did valuable work in the community. She'd visit the sick, deliver meals on wheels to the elderly, and worked as a secretary to the local vicar, helping arrange flowers for church. If that's not a pillar of the community, I'm not sure what is. When not working, Christopher busied himself with the local cricket club and the village green committee, a way of relaxing, I guess, from his high-profile, pressurised day job in the courts. But behind closed doors at the couple's luxury farmhouse, things were not always as peaceful and idyllic as expected. There were regular furious rows and extensive quarrelling. Some of the arguments were related to Rosemary, Susan's 26-year-old daughter, from her first marriage. Christopher was pretty old school in his thinking. As a barrister, who'd have thought it? And he was insistent that young people had things too easy and did not have the aptitude or work ethic to reach the top levels of a profession in the way that he'd worked himself so hard to achieve. Christopher was a man of habit. On a daily basis, he would return home from work, switch on the TV, have his supper and go to bed. Night after night, this was his routine. Talking or spending time doing stuff with his wife wasn't much of a priority for Christopher, and Susan was frankly a bit bored with this. She wanted more and increasingly became restless and craved excitement, something which she found through secret affairs with usually married men. A few years previously, in a bid to spice up her life, Susan had embarked upon an affair with a married farmer, Morris. The affair fizzled out after a couple of years when the farmer made it clear to Susan that he was not prepared to give up everything and leave his wife and children. When the news of this liaison reached Christopher Wybrow, and inevitably it did, he reacted with anger and surprise that his wife felt the need to have an affair. He raised an objection, as it were. Regardless, he did not want to lose his wife, and he was anxious to try and alter his ways to please her, and for him that was about spending money. He forked out almost £15,000 to have a tennis court constructed on their property, and he hoped this might ease some of her boredom. Christopher also treated Susan to flying lessons, something that she'd always wanted to try. But this decision would be a decision that would alter the course of their lives forever. In July 1989, Susan attended her first flying lesson, where she met the instructor, 55-year-old Dennis Saunders. She had lessons twice a week and she immediately struck up a friendship with her charming instructor. She would insist that it was always Dennis that gave her lessons, and it quickly became apparent that she was becoming more and more infatuated with him. Dennis was also married, he had four children, but Susan was an attractive woman who was charismatic and great fun to be with, and soon the relationship crossed the line. The pair would meet up for a drink in the bar after lessons, and were soon spotted openly kissing and flirting with each other, much to the surprise of other people at the flying club. One summer's evening in July 1989, Charles returned home from work to find the flying instructor having drinks with his wife in his house. He was furious, not just because of her past form with other men, but also because she had told him she was going out drinking with friends after her lesson, not sharing gin and tonics at home with her instructor. Charles couldn't contain his anger. He stormed upstairs to bed after demanding that Dennis left his home. Susan was not at all impressed that her husband had spoken to a friend of hers in this way in her home too. And Christopher and Susan didn't speak to each other for a full 10 days after this incident. 10 days, imagine that. The silence was finally broken by Susan when she denied to her husband she was having an affair with her pilot instructor. They were just friends. Christopher believed her. But not only was he being lied to about the affair, he was completely oblivious to the fact that his wife was secretly plotting to murder him. Susan, as it happened, had fallen head over heels for Dennis, and he felt the same way. They wanted to spend the rest of their lives together and live happily ever after. And this would all be so much easier without Christopher in the picture. The plot was actually hatched after Christopher had shown his wife a newspaper article about a man killed by his own lawnmower in a freak accident. Together with Dennis, she concocted a bizarre way to bump off her husband, and in doing so, she would become the welcome recipient of over £500,000 from his savings and life insurance. It's a huge sum today, but 30 years ago, it would be worth almost £2 million, nearly enough to buy a one-bedroom flat in Shoreditch. Having completely fallen for a flying instructor and the excitement a life of him might provide, the high life, the stage had now become set for violence. On the 18th of October 1989, Susan lured her husband into a trap in the sitting room of their home. He decided to work from home rather than his chambers in London, largely because Susan had been in a far happier mood of late. They seemed to be getting on much better. The reason for this upturn in mood, however, was a sinister one. Rather than rediscovering how she felt towards her husband, she was instead imagining her life without him and with her lover Dennis instead. Susan had already secretly taken Dennis to the house to lay in wait, ready to perform his part of the grand plan. The plan was that she would seduce her husband, who was working in his study, and they would end up having sex on the carpet. While smothering her husband in passionate kisses and with his back turned, Dennis Saunders would pounce and unleash a tirade of violence upon the unsuspecting barrister. The pair hit an immediate snag. Susan told her husband she was going to the toilet to freshen up before the planned session, but in reality she'd sloped off to tell Dennis how things were progressing as he lay hidden in another part of the house. When Susan returned to the study, she found that her husband had already excitedly stripped off. He was completely naked in anticipation of their romp. The two plotters needed him fully clothed what they had in mind, so Susan had to persuade him to redress by telling him she wanted to undress him herself as part of the foreplay. Christopher happily did this, still totally unaware that there was a third person about to get involved, and not in a good way. As Susan manoeuvred her husband from the study, the unsuspecting Christopher was suddenly attacked from behind. Tights were stuffed into his mouth, he was blindfolded, bound, gagged, and frog marched into the garden to the top of a steep bank above the pond. He stood there completely dumbstruck by what was happening, and he heard the sound of his ride-on lawnmower getting louder and louder as he was edged towards it. It's like something out of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre almost, isn't it? He must have been terrified, wondering what was going to happen, I guess assuming that he could be run over by it. But Christopher had no idea that this wasn't what was actually intended for him. The next stage of the plan was to try and create an accidental-looking scenario in which Christopher, who would at this stage be dead, and his body dumped in the pond, had actually taken a tumble from the mower and fallen into the duck pond where he would have been drowned. Even the best laid plans can fail though, and so it was here as Christopher put up a huge violent struggle, galvanised into action after hearing Dennis asking, "Where's the knife?" Hearing this, he became panic-stricken, and he managed to find the extra strength to break free of his ties, even whilst being beaten about the face by Dennis, who was also at this point trying to strangle him. The pair tumbled down the bank, onto a bed of brambles and nettles, and fought on amongst the vegetation. Christopher saw his wife watching and pleaded to her, "Please don't let him kill me." She coldly replied with, "You have been really horrible to me." Realising that his wife was in no mood for mercy, Christopher finally managed to release himself from the clutches of Dennis. He then managed to swim across the duck pond to safety before running to a neighbour's house. Look, I appreciate it almost sounds something out of a sitcom, doesn't it, when we recount it now? But no doubt at the time, it must have been so scary for Christopher. At first, the neighbour assumed that Christopher was drunk. He was, after all, absolutely drenched. He lost his shoes, had a bloodied face and was covered in pondweed. Not the usual look for the barrister. As he turned, he saw his wife and Saunders scrambling back up the bank, their plan having miserably failed. Knowing they'd failed so spectacularly and that the police would soon be on their trail, the hapless couple fled to Italy, using the passport of Saunders' wife. But bearing in mind Christopher's judicial backgrounds, they quickly realised that their capture was inevitable, and so returned after just a few days to face the music. They were both arrested on their return to England. Susan admitted that she'd experienced a terrible feeling of power as her lover beat up her husband. This, she said, was something she felt very ashamed of. She told police how they took their victim outside where no one would hear him. The only noise anyone would hear would be the lawnmower, and people would think he was just mowing the lawn. As far as Sanders was concerned, he told police he'd become infuriated when he saw bruises on Susan's body, and she had told him it was her husband who'd been hitting her. "I wanted to give him a good duffing up," he said, the same as he'd given her. The pair denied conspiring to murder Christopher Wybrow and conspiring to commit grievous bodily harm, but they did admit to conspiring to cause actual bodily harm and kidnapping. As you may recall, or certainly can imagine, Britain's tabloids loved this. They lapped up news of the story with vigour, as has always been the way when sex and intrigue come together. Throw in a lawnmower, and you can only imagine the excitement on Fleet Street. The front page of the Sun newspaper, if you can call it that, screamed a headline of "Fancy Sex on the Floor," while the Daily Mirror ran the headline "Sexy Wife's Plot to Kill Husband with Lawnmower." It really was a story that took some believing. In March 1991, Norwich Crown Court heard the six-day trial. Susan and Dennis Saunders pleaded not guilty to conspiracy to murder, although they did plead guilty to causing actual bodily harm. Charles Kellett, prosecuting, told the court that one of the most bizarre and harebrained schemes imaginable was actually sparked by the intended victim, who pointed out to his wife a Daily Telegraph report of a man who had died in a ditch after his lawnmower overturned. In wanting a life with her lover, Susan Wybrow realised that the only way she thought this could be achieved would be by ensuring her husband was dead. So not only would the coast be clear to maintain her relationship with Saunders, but she would also stand to inherit his considerable wealth upon his death. In the opening exchanges of the trial, Christopher Wybrow spoke of his love for his wife Susan. And whilst admitting that she was of a flirtatious nature, he loved her enormously. She was a bit of a flirt, her natural flirt, he said. There were difficult times. There were difficult times, but I still loved her enormously. I got on her nerves, but she didn't get on mine. He confirmed that behind the cosy and plush-looking exterior of Spring Farm, there were, and I quote, "sometimes scuffles and struggles between the two." Susan did not try to deny the affair with the flying instructor, telling the court that she fell in love with Saunders following the first few flying lessons he gave to her. "I thought he was wonderful because he could fly. I adore flying," she said. Things, though, started to change around 6 weeks into the affair, and she claimed that the situation started getting rapidly out of hand. "I think he thought I might end the affair. He told me that if I looked at another man, he would cut me up." She said that whilst in Saunders' house one day, he picked up a craft knife and said he would play noughts and crosses on her face. Similar threats were repeated several times. Susan also told the court she enjoyed being able to manipulate two men in her quest to inject incitement into her otherwise boring life. Cross-examining her, the QC challenged this, insisting that the reality was she was trying to deceive the jury, as had been her way with the men in her life. While she objected to this, she did actually admit that she had lied in respect of the brutality her husband had supposedly committed towards her. She claimed she made this up as Dennis Saunders told her it would sound better for the case. Saunders, though, stuck to this story as being the principal reason why he attacked Christopher Wybrow. When he took to the stand, he admitted that it was he who formulated the plan in response to having been told that Christopher was beating up Susan. "I cannot get it out of my mind that someone was mistreating the woman I loved," he said. In the prosecution's closing address, Charles Kellett told the court, "I suggest the reason behind this whole conspiracy was to allow Mrs. Wybrow at one stroke to lose her dull dog of a husband and gain control of his finances as his heir. Thereby, she'll be enabled to continue her life with her lover, Dennis Saunders. The motive behind all of this was her craving for excitement in her life." And Kellett dismissed the defence claims that Charles was only to be duffed up to teach him a lesson after his wife told Saunders that her husband had beaten her. In his summing up of the case, the judge warned the jury they should not sanitise what the couple did. Of Susan Wybrow, he remarked, "To encourage somebody else to beat up your husband is to start with a very disloyal act. To entice him with a promise of sexual intercourse, to be unmoved by his naked helplessness, to hold him in a passionate embrace, whilst you know that someone is going to assault him, to gag and bind and truss him deserves a strong word. Now, if you think this sounds like a particularly opinionated comment from a judge, I think you'd be right. And this language was consistent throughout the trial, as the judge was maybe, I don't know, showing some preference towards maybe somebody else in the same profession. He certainly seemed to have some kind of personal involvement in the case, often wading in at inopportune moments. In March 1991, Susan Wybrow and Dennis Saunders were both found guilty of plotting to kill Christopher Wybrow. Susan was sent to prison for 8 years. Dennis was ordered to spend 10 years in prison. In passing sentence, the judge, who we know had been very forthright in his opinions, told Susan she'd been completely unmoved during the trial and had shown no remorse towards her husband. As the pair were taken down, Britain's tabloids moved on to their next scoop, leaving the convicted couple to reflect on their actions as they served their time at Her Majesty's pleasure. A further twist, though, wasn't far behind, ensuring that Susan and Dennis would not be out of the media focus for long. On the 13th of January 1994, with the pair having served a little under 3 years of their sentence, the Court of Appeal quashed their convictions and the pair were freed on bail, pending retrial. At the appeal hearing, lawyers for the couple had argued that the convictions were unsafe because the judge at their original trial had denied them a fair hearing by taking on the role of the prosecution and interjecting when both defendants were trying to give their evidence. It was claimed that the judge descended into the arena, prevented each of the defendants giving their evidence, and intervened with such frequency and hostility that there was no chance of a fair trial for either. Furthermore, he'd even conveyed to the jury his own personal disbelief of the pair's evidence. Almost exactly 3 years after the first jury convicted Susan Wybrow and Dennis Saunders, the jury at the Old Bailey took just 4 hours to clear them of conspiracy to murder, believing instead that the pair had only intended to injure Christopher Wybrow. As the verdicts were delivered, Susan Wybrow trembled and could not contain her elation as she left court. In tears, she told reporters, "I'm just pleased they've come to the right verdicts." Dennis Saunders was equally as happy, beaming as he left court. But sadly, or not, there would be no happy ending for the newly released pair as far as their love affair went. Saunders instead sought a reconciliation with his own wife, who did indeed manage to forgive him. Impressive. Saunders doubtlessly happy to consign the sorry episode to history. Certainly he was very happy to forget about Susan, admitting in an interview following his release that he was very bitter towards her. He also confirmed one more time that murder had never been in their minds. And back in Suffolk, when news of Susan Wybrow's release was announced, the villagers of Leven Heath revealed their unanimous welcome of the verdict. The parish council clerk said, "The ladies of the village are delighted Susan is out of prison. She was always very well liked by everyone, and if she ever wanted to come back here, she'll be made very welcome. She did so much helping with the Meals on Wheels, collecting pensions and doing shopping for the old people. She was always full of gaiety and a real fun person with lots of friends. She is an attractive woman, of course, but she wasn't just popular with the men. Women liked her as well." Christopher Wybrow was far more reluctant to pass comment following the release of his two attackers. Refusing to speak publicly about the events, he did get some support from the locals of the Hare and Hounds pub, where he used to enjoy a pint with the village cricket team. The landlord pinned a notice to the pub door which read, "No hawkers, circulars, or people poking their noses into affairs that don't concern them." Now, who knows? Perhaps if the judge had not poked his nose into the affair, Susan Wybrow and Dennis Saunders may well have had to serve a much longer prison sentence. So what do you make of what we've heard today? Of course, the jury found them not guilty of murder, attempted murder rather, and we were not in court hearing the evidence. But I tend to feel they got off lightly, don't you? What always amazes me in stories similar to this is that they actually decided to take violent action. I mean, I get it that some people want to have affairs, although how they have the time, energy, or ability to lie so easily is beyond me. But to get to the point where a fantasy conversation about bumping off an unwanted partner becomes reality, I just can't imagine that, can you? Why not just leave your partners? There's no need for the violence. But I suppose if that's what she had planned, Susan wanted the money too, I guess. But in the end, what do you or I know about other people's lives? As I said at the start of this episode, none of us can really comprehend what really goes on in the lives of others. And I guess that's probably for the best. Thank you so much for joining me for this episode of the UK True Crime Podcast. To discuss this story and any other aspects of UK true crime, please head to Facebook and join over 93,000 of us who talk UK true crime 24/7. And to support the show, please do head to patreon.com/UKTrueCrime for 73, I think it is, bonus episodes and loads of other exclusive content. A huge thank you to the latest members of this community. That's Philip Dean and Catherine Louise. Thank you. Your support is so much appreciated. So why not come and join us? Join us today for under £1.50 a month. Cancel at any time. That's patreon.com/UKTrueCrime. Okay, so that's all from me, the host of the UK's 37th most popular true crime podcast, aspiring to the dizzy heights of 36, for another week. A big thanks again to Chris Wood for researching and writing this story. And I will hopefully see you on Sunday on Crowdcast for the latest episode of the True Crime Podcasters Roundtable with the boys from Twisted Britain. Then I will speak to you again on Tuesday for our next weekly episode of this podcast. So until then, please do take it easy. And remember, despite all the others, stay classy. Cheerio for now.